Did you know?
Did I know?
That fish are free from sin?
Is this something that you are concerned about? Are you concerned about fish's sin? The sin of fish?
Well, I was online, as I always am, because I have no life.
Right. And I mean, it is 2021. The fact that you're online isn't like, what are you, some kind of computer nerd?
And I was reading posts, and I saw a post that was like, are fish, like, forced to live with their sin because they can't repent? And the response to the post was, actually, we've extrapolated from the Bible that fish cannot sin because Noah never took any fish on the ark.
Okay.
Therefore, fish do not go to hell and are free from sin.
Is that the... I didn't know that that was why animals... Wait. Does that mean that other animals can go to hell? Does that mean like a giraffe can go to hell?
Yep.
Wow. I didn't know that. I did not know biblically speaking that giraffes were capable of going to hell. Or the giraffes were even capable of sin. That's comes as big news to me.
Are you sure? Have you seen those necks?
I've seen some of the necks. Oh, not all of them, but...
Those necks are full of sin. It's just sin stacked on top of each other.
So,
the more you sin, the longer your neck
gets. Is that a good measure of someone's sin, how long their neck is? That's good to know. I will, now whenever I see, like, a person who's like, ooh, like, look at her. Like, she's got such an elegant neck. I'd be like, Jezebel, sinner.
Look, have you seen geese? Geese and swans, man.
That's true. Turkeys, too. Quite a neck on them turkeys. Short necks on a chickadee, not big long neck. So are you saying chickadees are relatively free from sin?
Mm-hmm.
Good, because I do like a chickadee.
Geese, however, not free from sin.
They're nothing but sinners.
Geese are sin incarnate. You know what else is sin incarnate?
Yes.
The main character of this book.
Is that why you shared this with me? Fish are free from sin.
Stan Carlyle, not free from sin.
Not free from sin. I think that's a good segue into our new miniseries. What is our new miniseries? And what are we? Nightmare and who are we? Whom are we?
Whom are we? We are It's Del Toro Time.
We are It's Del Toro Time. That's the way we begin the show every time.
I almost said this is Deep in Bear Country. It is not Deep in Bear Country.
Although you were on the latest episode of Deep in Bear Country.
Mm-hmm.
So a person might be confused listening to this.
The Good Deed Scouts are also free from sin.
Are they free from sin? If you're interested in knowing what we're talking about, tune into my other podcast, Deep in Bear Country, and learn all about the Good Deed Scouts and the worst book in the world. Yes, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And... It's Del Toro time. It is Del Toro time. And
we said that way more casually than we usually do.
It is Del Toro time. And it's specifically Del Toro time because this is the first part of our multi-part miniseries on Nightmare Alley. We are going to be covering, as we said, the book in two parts. We'll be covering the original movie, and then we'll be covering Guillermo del Toro's new film, Nightmare Alley, 2021's Nightmare Alley. So it's a good four-part celebration of this wacky novel.
Mm-hmm.
What's the basic structure of this book? Just how's it set up?
The book is it's in chapters, or it's in cards, technically. It's each card of the tarot deck.
Yes.
And for the first three chapters, I took extensive notes, and then I got really bored of it, and I was like, whatever, I'll just read the book.
You got bored of the book, or you got bored of taking notes?
I didn't get bored of the book. I got stressed by the book. The book is very stressful. Once I figured out how the book was structured and how everything related to each other with the structure of the book, I didn't have to take notes because I could sort of piece everything together myself.
Okay.
But the first three chapters, I took notes because I was wondering like how everything fit together.
So Nightmare Alley is by William Lindsay Gresham, and he published it in 1946. Now, what do you know about William Lindsay Gresham?
I know that he was dealing with alcoholism at the time of writing this book.
He sure was. The intro to this book was written
by Nick Toshes.
I think that's how you say his name. The late Nick Toshes, who was actually working on a biography of William Lindsay Gresham when he died. And now I assume he was taking notes or something, but that all went to the grave with him because no one's ever followed up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a shame because apparently Nick Toshis knew everything about there was to know about William Lindsay Gresham, and everybody else in the world knows very little about William Lindsay Gresham.
You know, we could hold a seance and call his spirit here.
We could hold a seance and someone could pretend to call his spirit.
Exactly.
Now, he was born in 1909 in Baltimore, Maryland. He had.
Are we talking about Nick or William?
William Lindsay Gresham.
Okay.
1909, Baltimore, Maryland. If he was alive today, he'd be very old. He is not alive today, by the way, and his death was a sad one. But he had a rough life. As you said, he battled alcoholism his whole life. I believe he battled mental illness his whole life. If you're
dealing with alcoholism, there's going to be underlying causes to that.
But like his son, I believe his son David was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a young man. So there's mm-hmm. like the genetic, I believe, tendency. Also the fact that like he just sort of had an erratic life. He joined the Loyalist forces during the Spanish Civil War, which is another like Del Toro tie-in. Mm-hmm. Like he was there. He volunteered as a medic during the Spanish Civil War. And but he also worked as a folk singer. He like was like a handyman. He did like everything. He had like job.
Did he use a coin to call the spirit of George Washington to scare away a scary ferryman?
Wait, what is that from?
It's from that one short story.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. I forgot about that. That was John the Balladeer. You're right. Yeah. Yes. No, he was not a traveling folk singer traveling through the Appalachian Mountains battling wizards and witches.
Re-listened to that episode.
You know what, though? He may have been. We don't know much about William Lindsay. For all we know, he did live in the Appalachian Mountains and fight magical wizards. We don't know. He was friends with a guy named Joseph Daniel Doc Halliday, who worked in carnivals. It was a carnival worker and kind of started off like the beginning of William Gresham's education about carny life. He eventually married Joy Davidman, who many people may know as the later wife of C.S. Lewis, who would go on to write her own books, who would go on to die of cancer, and who would go on to inspire the book A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis and be played in multiple films and on stage in the play Shadowlands. So Joy Davidman was married to William Lindsay Gresham. He was a terrible husband. He was physically abusive. He was an alcoholic. They had two kids together. She found Jesus. William found Jesus, but it didn't stick. She went to England, met C.S. Lewis, fell in love, and the rest is history there.
You know, it's funny because one of my main questions for this episode is, why does this guy hate women so much?
He actually left Joy Davidman for her own cousin, Renee Rodriguez.
Why does this guy hate women so much?
I believe he has a lot of problems.
She
got out of an abusive marriage to be with William Lindsay Gresham. I don't know how that turned out for her. There's actually no pictures of Renee Rodriguez. I can't find any photos of Renee Rodriguez. Don't know much about him. But he tried to get his life in order in many different ways. And one of those ways was through spiritualism. He knew a lot of magicians at the time, like people who were part of the spiritualist movements and were like wizards and magicians. He studied tarot extensively. And it became a big part of his life. He would later go on to write the book Monster Midway, which is a nonfiction book about the carnival, and which I've only been able to read bits and pieces of online, and is fascinating. Like, if you want to know everything there is to know about the carnival, he wrote about it, like, down to their weird slang and, like, the history of certain, like, magic tricks and stuff, just all over the place. And then he was diagnosed with cancer, checked into the Hotel Carter in Manhattan, and took his own life. All he had in his pockets was he had his insurance card and a weird set of business cards that are the most depressing thing in the world. That said, they said, no address, no phone, no business, no money, retired. And then another card that said, you would rather die than face truth. Yeah, so he wrote this book based on what he knew about the carnival, what he knew about spiritualism, what he knew about seances, his own beliefs in God and Christianity, and it got purchased to be made into a movie the following year. He got a bunch of money for it. He blew all of his money, and he just spiraled after that. So, yeah, that's where we start with Nightmare Alley. A book that is not upbeat.
I have a hard time feeling sorry for this guy. I'm sorry, I do.
For our hero?
No, for the guy who wrote this book.
William Lindsay Gresham. Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I feel bad in the sense that I feel bad for anyone who has untreated mental illness and mm-hmm. probably needed more help. But he actually when I say like he had untreated mental illness, it was kind of treated. He went to a psychiatrist. Like he saw
and
help.
You can
he
see
just...
how that turned out by reading this book.
Yeah, he doesn't have a high opinion of psychiatrists. He and his wife dabbled in Scientology in the early days of Scientology. They weren't Scientologists. But he tried everything to figure things out. I think he's one of those people who, on top of mental illness, he couldn't stop thinking, like, ever. He couldn't turn his brain off. And so,
hey,
like,
I get that.
He just spiraled constantly.
Get that.
Yeah. So, and then he, of course, was an alcoholic, and that didn't help. So... Mm-hmm. All of his best features he put into the protagonist of Nightmare Alley, who is also...
This man has no good features.
Not a great guy. Stanton Carlyle. Yeah, our hero.
It's a great name, though.
This book
is full
man,
of great names.
It's full of great names. It's full of great characters. It's not full of unlikable characters. There's some likable characters in here.
Like Xena.
Like Xena, warrior princess.
Mm-hmm.
So this book starts off, the first chapter, the first card, The Fool. Stan Carlyle stood well back from the entrance of the canvas enclosure, under the blaze of a naked light bulb, and watched the geek. The geek was a thin man who wore a suit of long underwear dyed chocolate brown. The wig was black and looked like a mop, and the brown grease paint on the emaciated face was streaked and smeared with the heat and rubbed off around the mouth. At present, the geek was leaning against the wall of the pen while around him a few, pathetically few, snakes lay in loose coils, feeling the hot summer night and sullenly uneasy in the glare. One slim little king snake was trying to climb up the wall of the enclosure and was falling back. Stan liked snakes. The disgust he felt was for them, at their having to be penned up with such a specimen of man. Outside, the talker was working up to his climax. Stan turned his neat blonde head toward the entrance. Where did he come from? God only knows. He was found on an uninhabited island 500 miles off the coast of Florida. My friends, in this enclosure, you will see one of the unexplained mysteries of the universe. Is he man or is he beast? You will see him living in his natural habitat, among the most venomous reptiles that the world provides. Why, he fondles those serpents as a mother would fondle her babes. He neither eats nor drinks, but lives entirely on the atmosphere. And we're gonna feed him one more time. There will be a slight additional charge for this attraction. But it's not a dollar, it's not a quarter, it's a cold, thin dime. 10 pennies, 2 nickels, the tenth part of a dollar. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Stan shifted over to the rear of the canvas pen.
The characters we're introduced to are Stan Carlyle, Clem Oatley, the geek, and the drunk. Stan Carlyle is kind of a judgy jerk.
He's young, too. He's like 21 years old.
Yeah. He's new to the circus. He asks a lot of questions, and he likes snakes.
He does like snakes. He feels bad for the snakes.
He's the central character. I didn't get that he was the central character for the first couple of chapters, because there was a lot going on.
Yeah, they throw a lot of characters at you.
Yeah. I'm just going to call him Clem, because I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Yeah, I think it's Hoatley.
The owner of the 10-in-1 show, which is what the circus is called. So he's Stan's boss. He's the announcer dude.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really care about anything at all, except for like keeping the show up
and keeping his performers out of jail.
Yeah, and he's like, if I was anyone else, I'd fire you for asking all these questions, but you know, whatever.
Yeah,
there's the geek, which you know, we all know what a geek is. We've seen Freaks.
So this it's interesting, this book parallels Freaks in a few ways. I think this book has a far darker attitude towards the circus than Freaks did. This is not a loving family as Freaks.
I think it can be read in two different ways. I think from Stan's point of view, I don't think he really has a healthy view on what a family is.
Which we
read about later on.
Right.
But also I think that they're not necessarily, I mean, family isn't all smiles and joy and stuff. I think they do keep each other out of trouble, and they have each other's backs.
They
and
do.
If somebody breaks that, like, pact, yeah, they go full, like...
Ham?
They ham on them.
Yeah.
Like what happened to Sailor Boy.
Well, I also feel, though, that Freaks painted it more as, like, this is all we've got. Whereas a lot of the characters in this book are like, I'm just looking for the next thing. Like,
which even we get to in the next chapter, which we'll talk about then. But I want to finish talking about this chapter first.
Yeah. So, but describe the geek, because this comes back. Because Stan is like, where do you find this geek?
We learn that he is a drunk that was desperate for booze, and through Stan's point of view, he sees him as less than human, as does the audience. But he's marketed as like a person from an island that is like a foreigner and like can bite the heads off of chickens and stuff.
Yeah.
And that the geek doesn't come to the circus. He gets hired by the circus to pretend to bite the heads off of chickens.
Right.
But once the circus is like, all right, we don't need you anymore, he's like, wait, I need the drink. So he starts actually doing it. It's very dark and horrible and awful.
Yeah. Because Stan at the beginning is just like, where do you find this guy? Like, wow, is he like, wow, like, how did you hire him? And that's when, what's his face is like,
Clem.
Clem is just like, he's just a drunk. Like, you basically trick someone into doing this, and you get him so addicted to the job because they want their booze that they'll do it for nothing. Like, they'll do it for booze. And Stan, instead of being like, oh my God, that's terrible, is like, oh my God, that's kind of brilliant.
Yeah. It's really interesting because this book is full of people who are alcoholics. And we get introduced to the drunk as well, the character of the drunk who's in the audience. And it's weird seeing the alcoholic being the geek, being watched by the alcoholic in the audience. I thought that was a really interesting parallel, and like sort of it was very telling about what this book was going to be about.
And the world is very much set up as it's us and them. Like the 10-in-1 show's employees, even if they hate each other, they've clearly set themselves above the outside world, who are nothing but rubes, who are nothing but people just waiting to be fleeced of their money. And everyone's got a game. When we start seeing the other shows, like, everyone's doing their show, but they're also trying to sell extra stuff on the side to make a little extra cash. And you're doing what you can to fleece the rubes before they catch wise and before they go on to the next thing in their lives.
I did mark down a lot of what the Fool card meant because I thought it was interesting. The Fool means new beginning, which is fair because it's the beginning of the story. Stan, the character, is starting a new life and career path. It also means not knowing what to expect and having faith. And Stan's boss not firing him is a sign of faith in Stan and faith in his future. Because he says, like, you have a bright future here, kid, or whatever. And that the story can sort of go in any direction.
And it is, like, at this point, Stan has nothing ahead of him but options. And this is kind of it's an interesting chapter because it's sort of just this extended introduction to our 10-in-1 show through inner monologues. Through Clem's barking and then the inner monologues of these people. And
so we have Bruno Hertz. He's the strong man.
Herculo.
Yeah. He's the strong man. He's crushing on Molly and he's German. You can tell because he puts German words in there sometimes. It's funny because his inner monologue isn't in a German accent, but his speech is.
Right. He doesn't think in an accent.
Which is weird.
He probably thinks in German.
Yeah. Which I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Then we have the man with the best name, Kenneth Horsfield, or Major Mosquito, which is great.
He is a major mosquito.
He's the world's tiniest man.
Yes. And he is a...
A total jerkwad, because I can't say the words. He's very angry. He hates women.
He's psychotic.
And he wants everything to burn to the ground.
Yeah.
And the excuse that the rest of the carnival gives is like, if you were a man stuck in a child's body, you'd probably want to burn everything to the ground too.
Right. He's very much I can't remember the character's name, but the little person actor from Freaks, who's the main character. Because he's very small and he looks like a child.
Then there's Joe Plasky. He's called the half man acrobat. He was born with legs that he couldn't use, like in the movie Freaks. He speaks to the audience himself. He's the first one in the book to do that. He doesn't let Clem to speak for him. And his nieces and nephews, or I said nibblings because that's what the internet calls them, have whooping cough, and he's trying to get money for his sister to give to them.
And I assume he is based on the actor from Freaks, because it's very similar roles. He's kind of like the level-headed guy in the group.
Yeah.
He's also really strong, as we find out later.
Which is pretty cool. There's Francis Xavier Martin, the tapestried man.
Yes.
He's a creepazoid.
Covered in tattoos.
Yeah, he doesn't like Bruno.
Nope. Does he like Molly.
He likes women. It's just sort of... Well, he doesn't like women.
No, he doesn't like women at all. He might be a rapist.
Yeah, he's not a good person.
No, he's not.
Then there's Mary Margaret Cahill, or Molly, as she's called. She is advertised as being immune to electricity, it's a pretty dope circus act, to be honest. She has the longest introduction.
Yeah, it's an extended flashback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of her and her relationship with her father, which sheds light on her behavior and sort of is a parallel to Stan.
Yeah, was her relationship with her father good or bad?
It was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, she had this father who was obviously like kind of a lowlife and a gambler.
And some sort of con man.
Yeah, but who treated her really well and tried to like protect her from the world. Like, and was really nice to her. Like, even when she like walked in on him with a woman, he was like, I got this. Her life may not have gone great if he hadn't died, but... It certainly isn't going any better because he died.
She's a daddy's girl. I said she's sweet but not naive.
Yeah.
She seems young and inexperienced, but she has an understanding of how the world works. It's just sort of a young understanding.
Yeah, I don't think that you do well in a 10-in-1 act, a traveling carnival, if you don't know a little bit about the world. Like, you got to be a little wise.
Like, her father protected her from the world, but he didn't hide the world from her. Like, he explained, like, she's interesting. I like her a lot.
And she's saving herself for the right man.
Yeah. And I also marked down that men seem to be drawn to her.
Right.
Because she's young and pretty. Mm-hmm. We have Stanton Carlisle, who gives his introduction. He's a magician. He still judges the audience. That's, like, his main character point at this point. He gives tiny monologues in his own head about how stupid the audience is. And he wants to be able to read people, like our next character, Xena, the fortune teller. She is the only act in this that doesn't get her own inner monologue.
Right, but we get enough of her outer monologues later.
But her introduction is entirely through the lens of Stanton.
Yeah.
Like, we don't get a third view of her, like a third person view of her. We don't get like an unbiased view of her. We just get it through Stanton's eyes.
Yeah. And I think part of that is probably because Xena doesn't hide anything in this story. Mm-hmm. She's pretty open and honest about who she is and her objectives, her goals. She's older. She's, you know, probably, I think she's supposed to be in like her late 30s, early 40s.
Mm-hmm. She's married.
She's married. She's very pretty. And she's an attractive person. She's smart and kind. And she's married to Pete.
The other drunk in our story.
Yes.
There's a lot of drunk people in this story. Pete is the guy who does all the behind-the-scenes stuff for Xena's act. And we learn more about him, I think, in the next chapter.
Yeah. He's nice. He's a nice guy.
He's just dealing with a lot.
Yeah, he's going through it. He used to be Xena's, like, stage partner, and
he was the guy on stage. Then they were in a team. Then it was just her.
Yeah. Because he's succumbed to the alcohol too much. He can't deal on stage. So, yeah, she does blind readings of people in the audience, and also like people write down questions onto pieces of paper. Those questions go under the stage. They're replaced with fake questions that Xena burns in a bowl, and then the person below the stage will secretly hand up the written questions, which she then pretends to read from the minds of the people in the audience. But she's also a really good cold reader. She could just do that. And she says, she's like, she goes to Florida and she does palm readings like in the winter or whatever, and like makes a killing because she's just really good at it.
I think this is really interesting because of, I'm just going to call him William because I keep forgetting his last name.
Gresham.
Gresham's disdain for psychology and psychologists, because essentially what she is doing is super deeply rooted in psychology.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like she's just reading people.
Very much so.
and looking at their reactions and stuff. But it's not treated with the same disdain that the psychologist in the story is treated.
No, he's in the book that Gresham wrote on sideshows on this very subject. In the little bits and pieces I was able to find online, he talks about these cold readers who knew human behavior so well, who were so observant that they would do cold readings on him, and he would know their tricks, and he would still be convinced they were mm-hmm. psychic. He's like, I know this is a trick, and you're so good at it. I can't figure out how you're doing it. And like, he knew professionals who would do it at like giant clubs, and they'd be like, oh, well, this woman who I just read, like, I've seen her come in for the past 6 weeks, and I've been watching her behavior for a month and a half. Like, I know mm-hmm. her story because she's not new. Like, and you're like, oh God, like these people just know, like, they have to know everything that's going on around them. And like, yeah, you're right. Like, you have to be able to read, psychologically read people so well, they think you're reading their mind.
Yeah, like my therapist.
Right. Except hopefully your therapist isn't doing it for their own nefarious reasons.
I mean, if nefarious reasons means getting paid, that's why Zine is doing it. That's why my psychologist is doing it.
So we learn from his inner monologue that Stan is ambitious and that mm-hmm. he's attracted to Xena, but mostly because he sees her as like a stepping stone. He sees her as like a way up the ladder to what? We don't know yet.
He sees her as the High Priestess.
Card number three, the High Priestess.
But first I want to talk about card number two, the Magician card, because I want to talk about what the Magician card means. It's sort of a sign to tap into one's full potential and not hold back. It represents talents, capabilities, and resources used to reach your full potential. And also, the Magician is represented by Stan Carlyle in this, as he is a magician. But this is sort of Stan being like, I want to do what Xena does, and sort of reaching out to get to his full potential.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating to me how each chapter of this book is so wrapped around the tarot card that, I don't know, it's just very cool.
So speaking of the High Priestess, this is the chapter. Chapter three is the chapter where, like, the wheels of the plot really start, mm-hmm. really start cranking along.
Yeah.
The carnival, the traveling carnival, is coming to a new town. Stan is traveling with Xena and with Molly, and they talk mm-hmm. a lot about just their lives, and they learn a little bit about each other, and Stan and Xena begin to have a relationship together.
Later we get the idea that Stan is jealous of Pete and wants Xena to himself.
Yeah.
And I can't tell if he's jealous of Pete. He's obviously resentful of Pete. I can't tell if he's jealous of Pete because he wants Xena, or if he's jealous of Pete because he wants the notoriety of being a mentalist.
I think it's both, because the way Stan behaves is the way a young guy behaves when he's really into this new relationship and the woman is very busy and has a lot of responsibilities mm-hmm. and she doesn't have any time for him. He feels put off. She keeps putting him off because she's got a husband who is an alcoholic and who she loves and is trying to take mm-hmm. care of. So you get a lot of like, come on, let's go to your place. And she's like, I am busy, dude. I have got a life.
Yeah,
and
you can tell this because Xena snubs him when he's like, let's have sex. And was like, look after my husband while I go grocery shopping. And I'm like, that's a great idea, Xena. Good job.
So Xena is worried that that Pete is going to get, you know, like, she's trying mm-hmm. to keep the alcohol away from Pete. She doles out the alcohol at better or worse times, depending on like what Pete needs to be doing. And so Stan has a long conversation with Pete.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn a lot about Pete in this.
Yeah.
In this chapter,
mm-hmm.
And Stan sneaks him a bottle of what he thinks is cheap booze.
Well, he's intending to cause Pete to pass out.
Yes,
I don't really know why.
Because he wants to get together with Xena.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
he wants Pete out of the way for the evening.
Yeah, but it's not fun drink. It's not fun alcohol. It's, what is it called?
It's wood alcohol.
Wood alcohol. And he gives Pete the wood alcohol, and it kills him.
Yeah. They wake up the next morning. Pete has been found dead.
Major Mosquito's like, that idiot drank the wood alcohol.
Yeah, Major Mosquito is not a nice man.
I love him, though.
And Stan's, the wheels in Stan's head begin to turn even harder. Again, he's not a nice guy, and he's really he sees everything as an opportunity.
Well, first he's like, "Oh shoot, I'm gonna be arrested and charged for murder."
But that doesn't happen.
No. Like, then he's like, "Wait, Zeta can read my mind because she knows everything."
Right. So he is constantly worried that Xena is going to figure out what's going on or what happened. And you maybe feel that she may understand what happened, but
she at least understands that he feels guilty about something.
Right. But
because he does. I want to put it out there. This Stan guy is not a psychopath.
Right. He's morally ambiguous.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of people are. I can't.
He didn't. I think it's important to know he did not intend to kill Pete.
Yeah, and he feels bad about killing him.
Yeah, Pete was just, he's just like, that guy. He doesn't feel bad enough to, do anything about it. But then neither does Xena.
What can he do about it?
Xena is pragmatic. She's terribly sad, but she's also just like, I mean, Pete's dead. I got a life. I got a job. Yeah, I got a life to live, and I got to keep going. So Stan moves up to be Xena's assistant.
He still has his own act, though.
Yes, but he's learning from her now. She does a reading of a woman with an alcoholic husband.
I think, first, before we get to that, I think it's really interesting that Gresham chose Molly's act to go between Xena and Carlisle. Yeah. Like, that's just some blatant symbolism right there about what's going to happen in the future. I think it's really good.
Right. And they have to shuffle the acts, too, because, Stan is helping with Xena's act full time now. He doesn't have enough time to, change clothes between performances, his act and the other act. So, they have to reshuffle all the performances. They're on a train, training away. The men are all playing cards. The playing deck is noted to be marked. And there's a big fight because they're accusing each other of marking the deck.
This is the longest chapter in the world, by the way.
And I'm like, how can you even begin to play cards
that
with circus people?
That was an intentional pun.
What?
I said this is the longest chapter in the world, by the way.
Oh, it is, because the chapter is called The World. Very good. Yeah. Xena decides to bring out her fortune-telling deck. And this is where we're introduced to the tarot in this story. But Stan convinces Xena to teach him or to let him learn the code. Mm-hmm. And that is this particular verbal code that Xena and Pete had worked out to communicate what's going on in the audience and with people to each other live on stage without anyone being the wiser. And so if you phrase things in a certain way, it means certain things about these people. And it sounds like the most complicated thing in the world to learn.
I still don't really understand how it works at all.
They demonstrate it pretty well in the movie, if I remember correctly. And I was like, oh, this is hard. Like, if you say yes, ma'am. And do you have anything to ask? It's like, okay, if you say, do you have, that means this is a spinster. Anything to means that this is a person who is traveled with a baby. Ask. It's just everything has a deeper, darker, like a psychological meaning. It's an incredibly complicated code, again, based on real tricks people used. I guess if you're going to go hard if you're going to be a psychic.
He learns this all in one night.
He starts cramming like a college student. He starts cramming like a guy at the end of a guy at the end of midterms, just trying to get a passing grade. And he says she covers a lot for him. Xena is so good at cold reading that it's a learning curve. He's gradually learning and she's having to do less and less filling in the blanks for him. But they start using the code against marks in the South. And this is where we get the what Nightmare Alley even means. What is the Nightmare Alley? Do you remember?
It's a recurring dream that Stan had that is there's a light at the end of the alley and you can't get to it because it keeps getting farther away. And in the South, the North is the Nightmare Alley.
Exactly. And everyone has their Nightmare Alley is the is basically the idea behind this entire book. Everyone has the thing they are trying to reach, the light at the end of the darkness that you no matter how hard you run, you can't leave the Nightmare Alley. It's your Nightmare Alley. It's the alley in a nightmare. And that comes back over and over again. This is also where Stan learns that you can rule people by knowing their fears. That everybody has fears. The drunk is afraid of not getting another bottle. You know, like this person's afraid of being lonely. This person's afraid of going to jail. Like once you know what a person's fear is, you know how to control that person.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big deal.
I'm trying to find any explanation for the code. I just don't get it.
It's complicated.
There's no explanation. He's just like, this means this. And I'm like, where did you get that from?
I believe that in Gresham's book about sideshows, it is gone into in greater detail. I wish I could buy a copy of that book. It's very expensive used. It's never been republished.
How much is it used?
I don't remember. Too much for me. And I don't have it in my lap right now, so it doesn't matter.
How much is it used? Tell me
after this episode. I don't know. I will figure it out. Okay. So we also get Sailor Martin, our good friend Sailor Martin, Francis Xavier Martin.
The worst. He's the worst. I hate him.
He gets into an argument with a local and he starts what is called a hey rube. Do you know what a hey rube is? It's one word. Hey rube. It's a circus
term.
Isn't
it just like a scam?
No. Hey rube is a thing you say if you are a sideshow person or a carnival worker, and you are getting into an altercation with a rube. And you need the entire circus to stop what they're doing and come back you up. You don't call a hey rube lightly because it literally... Yeah,
I didn't get that from the book at all.
Literally everyone stops what they're doing and comes to your... I believe today hey rube is used more to like signal that like something bad is going down. Mm-hmm. Like you would say like, hey rube, and everyone knows like, put your ears up, like someone's getting drunk and just like there's someone who's like getting out of hand. It doesn't necessarily bring people like with their fists flying anymore, but it's that thing you were talking about, like the people in the circus take care of their own, even if it's Sailor Martin, except
even though no one seems to want to go over to him with
no one wants to help Sailor Martin because everyone hates Sailor Martin. He's a jerk and he started it because he tried to they said like, don't try to pull any fast ones on these people. We want to keep things nice in this town. It's a tough town. And he tries to cheat a guy out of some money and the guy wants his money back. And Sailor Martin gets fired.
First, he gets attacked.
He does get attacked, which is nice.
He is choked out.
By?
His name is Joe.
By Joe Plasky, the half man acrobat who knows jujitsu, which is awesome.
Yes. I love him. He's great.
He's great. I wish there was more of him. The cops eventually show up, most likely because Sailor Martin snitched on the circus.
Not most likely. It's said he snitched on the circus.
And the cops show up. It's a very, very, very conservative town. They dislike the fact that the 10-in-1 is there anyway. And they basically choose Molly at random to arrest because she's wearing a very skimpy outfit. And Stan to the rescue comes in, convinces them that Molly needs to wear her skimpy outfit so that she's not killed by electricity. And then he does an incredible blind reading on the deputy.
Mm-hmm.
Like an incredible blind read. It's so brilliantly written, and he just melts this old deputy's heart. And
it's so good.
And
so good.
I wrote in my notes this. I wrote this. I wrote. Stan does a blind reading on the old deputy and saves Molly from being arrested. They have sex. And it sounds like Stan and the deputy have sex. But no, it's Stan saves Molly from being arrested. And then
isn't Molly like 16?
I don't think she's 16. 16, 17, something like that.
I'm pretty sure it said earlier that she was 16.
She's saving herself for a good man. And well, she found a good man in Stanton Carlisle. So they begin to have a relationship. Stan is now pretty much done with Xena, and we're on to chapter 5. Oh boy, this has taken us a long time. Chapter 5, The Empress. This is where Stan and Molly run off together.
They don't really.
They plan on running off together.
I mean, they're kind of forced into running off together.
Right, how come?
Because Rune was like, so you guys had sex, right? And they're like, what?
Isn't that the worst? Poor Bruno.
I feel bad for Bruno. He's just a German man. He's just a German man.
Yeah. He's just this guy. He loves Molly. He's attracted to Molly. He's too embarrassed to ever say anything to her. He's probably way too old for her.
And also he wants what's like best for her. Like he's sort of kind of a fatherly figure.
Mm-hmm.
Cause Xena says, yeah, if Francis Xavier Martin never went after her, Bruno'd probably beat him up.
Right.
And also, I'd beat him up. I love Xena. She deserves better.
She does deserve better because Bruno spills the beans that Stan and Molly have been together. And that's
two
when
minutes
they're like,
ago.
That's when they're like, yeah, we're gonna leave. We're gonna start our own thing. And Xena, the most gracious person in the circus, is like, I'll do you a tarot reading, honey. And that's when Molly gets the Empress and Stan gets
the hanged man.
Do you know what the Empress means in tarot?
Associated with maternal influence, the card if you're hoping to start a family.
Yep.
The Hanged Man is the card of ultimate surrender.
Interesting.
A sacrifice to the greater good.
Ooh. Hmm. That's interesting. Yes.
His facial expression is calm and serene, suggesting that he is in this hanging position by his own choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Tarot cards are interesting that way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting because all of the choices Stan has made has led to this moment.
Uh-huh.
But it makes sense when you makes sense for how the book goes.
They run off together, and the next chapter, Resurrection of the Dead, is five years on.
Yeah. I mean, they haven't gotten divorced yet, so that's great.
It's 5 years later. Stan and Molly are doing pretty well for themselves. They're pretty successful as a double act. She's having trouble. He's unhappy. She keeps like slipping up in their act. He sees his mother, or he thinks he does.
I thought he just had a memory moment.
Well, he sees a woman at a hotel and he's like, it's her. And then it triggers a flashback to his mom, who was kind of a jerk.
His family was sort of a disaster. Yeah. I don't know if she was a jerk. I mean, she was clearly a jerk to her child.
And to her husband.
I mean, her husband was also a jerk.
He was also a jerk. She was cheating on her husband.
Wasn't he also cheating on her, though?
I guess that's true, but he had cheated on her or something. She's cheating on him. And then she convinces Stan, who was a very young boy, to lie for her, even though Stan clearly saw his mom with this other guy.
At first he doesn't know that he saw his mom with him.
Right,
though.
But it becomes very clear. He doesn't just see them together. He sees them together.
Yeah.
In a park.
He sees them having, not in a park, in a secret alcove.
Well, yes.
Called the Glade.
In the outdoors, though.
Yeah.
And she bribes him to be quiet by buying him a magic set.
Technically, she doesn't bribe him yet. She just says, like, tell your father you were with me. And he was like, okay. And then she gets him the magic set.
She gets him the magic set, yeah. He dislikes his dad, I guess, more than he dislikes his mom.
I think it's that whole Oedipus complex sort of thing that they're getting at here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not healthy, whatever it is.
It's not healthy, but he's seemingly attracted to his mother as the first female, like the first woman in his life.
Right.
And his dad isn't around. And when he is around, things seem to go poorly.
So the next chapter is called The Emperor. This is mostly all just stuff about their deteriorating marriage and his like weird career. Mm-hmm. Because they're at a fancy party to present their act. They have like this whole electrical rig set up where like Stan can tap his toes. But Stan gets this note before they do their performance that it gets them all upset and very angry. And later on, Molly uncrumples the note, and we see that it's a note that says,
"Don't mingle with the guests."
Yeah, don't mingle with the guests, and that only makes Stan want to get even bigger and more powerful with his act.
I got a note like that, I'd be like, "Oh, thank God, I don't have to mingle with this annoying people."
Because he's going to these really fancy parties, people think he's awesome and great, but he's still not part of the actual crowd. Reminds me a little bit of Barry Lyndon. Yes, it's like Barry Lyndon, like. He's got a lot, but he doesn't have it all, and he wants it all.
Molly's like, I just want it. I just stop.
Yeah, he's not happy with Molly. She's not happy with him. She's kind of miserable in the relationship. He doesn't let her leave the apartment. She's at home all the time. He promised her children at some point. No, he's about to promise her children because in the next chapter, the son. Stan is like, we got to up our game. We cannot just be phony baloney fortune tellers anymore. We're going to be phony baloney spiritualists. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a seance cone in this book, which
I love the seance cone.
We get real use of the seance cone. Stan convinces Molly to start doing a spiritual act. She is totally against it. Like, this is now, morally, he's dipping into stuff that she is not okay with, which is pretending I'm talking to someone's dead child.
Do you think that this chapter is meant to represent the upright son or the reversed son?
I don't know. Which is which?
So, the upright son is happiness, success, optimism. And the reversed son is excessive enthusiasm, unrealistic expectations, and conceitedness.
Probably the second one?
But which one do you think Carlyle thinks it is?
Maybe the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting that Carlyle's view sort of represents the positive meaning of certain cards, while the reality is the negative meaning.
Right. There's one thing that Gresham says in his nonfiction book, which is that tarot cards are, there's many different schools of tarot card thought, mm-hmm. and like what they mean, what the meanings are. And his whole philosophy was like, there's no meaning to the tarot card, but you still have to study the meanings of the tarot cards. Mm-hmm. But you ultimately bring to the tarot what you want. You have to learn a lot about them, but it's still all completely up to your own influence and your own interpretation.
Did he actually believe in spiritualism, or was he just interested in the act of spiritualism?
From what I've been able to gather, what little we know of him, what little I've been able to read about him, William Lindsay Gresham wanted something to save his life, and he was mm-hmm. willing to believe in whatever it took in order to be saved, in order to find meaning in the world. And he turned to tarot, I believe, because it helped him channel that meaning. I don't think he mm-hmm. believed it was magic, because he was also a devout Christian for a mm-hmm. long time. But I believe that he thought that the tarot was important and meaningful in divining your own, like, who you were, figuring out your place in the world. Mm-hmm. That's just my interpretation of his interpretation of the tarot.
So, like, he didn't believe that the tarot actually showed the future, but that the tarot showed you what you thought the future was going to be.
I mean, I don't believe that many legitimate tarot card readers believe the tarot shows the future.
No, I
believe
know.
I believe that they, you know, you choose the card and then they're able to divine a fortune for you, mm-hmm. which isn't your future. It's your it's just meaningful advice, or like a guide to your future.
Yeah, considering this book is all about paths not taken and choices that you make for the future, it's clear that there's not this sort of sense of, oh, this is how life was always going to end up because of some sort of divine decree.
Yeah.
But the tarot is used to sort of guide the reader through the story.
Exactly.
It's more of a guide than a lord, I guess, is what I would say.
Right. And I think that's what people, I mean, that's what I've heard people say about tarot, which mm-hmm. is that, like, you're not, it's not telling you the future. It's, the world is full of infinite choices. And what the tarot does is it narrows down those choices for you and gives you an idea of how they might go. Mm-hmm. And gives you an idea of where you might be at the time to make those choices.
It's really just a really fancy therapy session.
Pretty fancy. So Stan is ordained. He's now an ordained minister. And their gig is, Molly is supposed to be the medium. He's the minister who's like basically her keeper in their little mm-hmm. like setup. And they go to fancy, like, rich people's houses and they do seances. And she goes into a cabinet. It's very well done. Like, they set it up so that she's basically naked. So they're like, nothing up her sleeve. And they manage to summon the daughter of an older woman, like this old woman who's hired them.
Mm-hmm.
And the old woman is thrilled that her daughter died very young, and she wants to keep talking to her. Molly's like, I don't want to keep doing this. Stan has already promised to marry her and have a kid with her if she keeps doing it with him. But now he's like, I don't need you. I can find someone else. And he threatens to get rid of her if she doesn't stick with him. And this is where stuff starts really.
Because he's an a-hole.
Yeah, he is now, he is all in on this, and mm-hmm. she is not in on this at all. Like,
I wouldn't be in on this either. Look, I get it. He goes on and on about how, oh, this is just giving people hope. It's not meant to be like, but I'm like, you can't say you're summoning dead people and be like, this is hope, right? That's not cool, man. Have you seen any horror movies? It's not cool. It's not hopeful. It's just demons.
Right.
All you're doing is summoning demons. And the spirit cone proves it.
Well, this woman, Addie, just goes head over heels for Stanton and his gig. And he becomes like her regular minister, and Molly becomes a regular medium. We get a lot of descriptions in the next chapter of just how this whole thing works, like how she functions as a medium. Card number 9, the Hierophant, and it's a lot of it is devoted just to a description of the seance.
The book is very uneven in its distribution of chapters.
Yeah.
And we haven't been introduced to sort of the second antagonist.
No, we haven't even gotten to it. She doesn't show up until the very end of this first half that we're covering. Like the story is still just, it's still winding up. We haven't even gotten to the pitch yet. But he's never at home, but he's getting famous. There's articles being written about him, and this woman that he's connecting to her daughter is standing up for him in public. Molly is terribly unhappy. And Stan has a church at this point. He's now set up a full-on spiritual church.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels made between what a preacher does every day and what a mentalist, as Zena is called, does every day at the earlier chapters. Like, it's a lot of, like, this is just what a preacher does, except for fancier.
And the years keep passing. Like, time is going this whole time. By the time we get to chapter 10, the moon... Stan's hair has started thinning. How long has it gone on? It's been years now since Stan started doing all this. He has to build up this whole career.
It's funny because they spend so much on the beginning of the story and then they sort of rush through his rise to fame.
Yeah.
I feel like his fame isn't the focus of... it's obviously not the focus of the story. Even though he is the central character, he's not... as important as he's made out to be.
He does go visit his dad in a harrowing chapter. We get this reunion between him and his father. You find out that San's dad killed his dog.
You could tell from, like, even when the dog was first introduced, like, that was gonna happen.
And that kind of was what broke Stan, like, as a person.
If you killed my dog, I mean, you wouldn't be alive anymore, so.
It's a heartbreaking chapter. It's the one thing that, like, makes me go, like, oh, this guy wasn't psychically broken, like, as a young... And never had anyone there to put him back together.
He had two terrible parents. His dog was killed. And now he's a jerk because of it.
And that gets us to card number 11, The Lovers, which is Stan coming up with his big idea and beginning to put it into motion. We also find out that Stan has been sleeping around a lot behind Molly's back, seeing a lot of sex workers, seeing them enough that they know him. Like, he goes to cities and they're just like, the usual, Mr. Carlisle. But he goes to visit a psychiatrist. He makes an appointment with a psychiatrist named Dr. Lilith Ritter.
More symbolism.
And when he shows up at her office, she, like, puts him in a chokehold, slams him on the ground, and she's like, I thought I'd be hearing from you, Carlisle. You were never cut out to run a spook racket solo. And you suddenly realize, at more than the halfway point through the novel, that you're introduced to the actual, like, femme fatale of this story. She becomes the guiding force through to the end of this book. But yeah, and that's where we're going to leave our coverage of the book for now. As you said, the first three chapters of this book is like a novel's worth of information. And then it just keeps going. There's so much to this book, like, psychologically. There's passages in this that are gripping and fascinating. And it is a very dramatic story. Like, there's a lot of great scenes between characters. But yeah, I think a lot of it's still open to interpretation. And I agree with your assessment that, like, the presentation of a tarot card reading as you read the book is a great way of going, like, I'm not going to tell you everything in this book that's real and everything that's actually going on. It's kind of up to you. Like, but I'm giving you these cards as, like, little signposts along the way. You figure it out.
If this book wasn't open to interpretation, the inclusion of the tarot cards wouldn't make any sense. I don't think that this book is meant to mean one thing to everyone.
No. This is it's an unusual book. It's a must read if you're reading along. We will be covering chapters 12 through 22 next week.
Yeah. So next week while I'm getting ready for finals.
While you're getting ready for finals. That's why we're trying to keep these episodes brief, down to an hour. so that you have time to make a good grade. So that's it for this episode. Join us next week when we'll be covering the rest of the book. Willow, do you have anything else to add to this beginning? Nope. Yeah, we'll barrel through to the end. We'll have some like sum up. I do want to talk about the musical adaptation of this story
that I don't
that happened. I want to give a brief shout out to it. So I'll not because I think it's not for any other reason other than that it illustrates the flaws you can hit when trying to adapt something like this. You have to be very careful in how you adapt a story like Nightmare Alley and just trust the material to do its own work. But we'll cover that when we get to the end. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for listening. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Del Toro Time. You can find us on Facebook at It's Del Toro Time. You can listen to the latest Deep in Bear Country. You can hear me and Willow talk about the Berenstain Bears and the Little Lost Cub.
I feel like we talk more about other Berenstain Bears book in that episode than we do that one.
Well, because it is a very simple, very short book that there is not a whole lot to say anything about, but we do get into the policing in Bear Country quite a bit, and the fact that the bear cubs in those books are fairly useless. They're fairly useless. So, useless. Yeah, if you want to hear more of us talking about something besides these stories, listen to that episode of Deep in Bear Country. There's some good stuff in there.
If you want to hear us talk about a book free of sin, then go listen to that. If you want to hear us talk about a book full of sin, then continue listening to this show.
Continue listening to this show. But yes, thank you so much. We'll see you next week. And as you always, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when it's Del Toro time.